The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Sentiment is radically shifting, suggesting that this very well may be the big one. And what I mean by the big one, a major correction where people just basically say, I'm taking my marbles and going home. And those three words, I think, may be the most memorable words from 2015. Get me out.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, thank you. Thank you for going to China, because the leadership in China has now guaranteed that Chinese government will step in and back a nullification of volatility. And they have promised that we are near the bottom of this incredible crash that we've seen in the Chinese market.
Well, don't you know that central planners know something that you and I don't know? And that's the direction of the markets. They know not only where it will go today, tomorrow, and 5 years from now, but they know exactly how it's going to get there.
I thought you had something to do with that, though.
Yeah, we had some great conversations, certainly met with some very interesting, intriguing businessmen, as well as economists, some of the most important Chinese economists alive today. I sat with at dinner on two occasions, and then sat in lectures as well. And so I thought it was very, very informative. The reality is that on the ground, China is succeeding in some respects and failing in others. They're succeeding in their move away from investment and manufacturing and towards consumption as a core component in their economy. Services today represent a greater percentage than both infrastructure investment and exports combined.
Which is incredible, because China was built on exports, let's face it.
So that's the good news. And as I was in a panel discussion while overseas, I said sort of that there is this issue of the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you're familiar with the spaghetti western with Clint Eastwood from years and years ago. Wah, wah, wah. So that was the good news. There is the bad and the ugly. And it is that they have a tremendous amount of reform to take on. And it's in about five categories, and they're trying to get it all done at once, which may be more complicated than they can handle. That remains to be seen. There's a project that we'll talk about in future programs, not today, but about an $8 trillion project that is the equivalent of a Hail Mary pass. I mean, they're going for the next phase of globalization. They believe that they're going to be center to the next phase of globalization, and they're going to spend $8 trillion to make sure that they are center stage for growth in the 21st century. And again, I say it's Hail Mary because at the end of $8 trillion is the end of their bank account and the end of all forms of solvency. So if they get it right, maybe they are propelled, without the intervention of our U.S. State Department, of course, maybe they are propelled into the number one economic seat in the world. If they get it wrong, then they've squandered 40 years worth of savings and wealth accumulation.
China's in the news every day right now because they are taking the blame for the volatility that we have in our own markets. Now, I don't know that necessarily the blame is completely right, but what was your feel when you were in China? Is China the driver of the volatility worldwide, or are there other factors to that?
You know, the timing couldn't have been better to be on the road. We have a tremendous amount of volatility packed into a 1-2 week period, the third week of August. I mean, think of this. You have a 1,000-point decline in 1 week. And then the fourth week of August, we open up that week with a 1,000-point decline in a day. And actually, in the first 90 minutes of trading, that's Monday, the 24th of August, we have the Dow traveling 3,000 points as it gyrates up and down. And of course, you know, again, rolling back the clock to the preceding week, the preceding Thursday and Friday were the biggest two-day loss since November 19th and 20th of 2008. So it was a great time to be overseas, because to get the temperature of a lot of folks, economists and investors from Shanghai, from Shenzhen, from Singapore, from Malaysia, all over Malaysia, from Indonesia, and even a few people from Europe as well, this particular gathering was very, very talent-packed, I should say. And so their insights and their questions were unparalleled. And I think it cut right to the chase. What are the issues in play? And China, while it is an overarching concern because they have these issues of migration, you know, from the countryside to the big city, they have these issues of opening up the next phase of globalization, which, as I mentioned earlier, we'll talk about on another occasion. These are all big picture issues, which have nothing to do with the current volatility in the stock market. And this was the key. I think this is the key. There's more core things which have been lingering in the U.S. markets, which serve as the context for anything being a trigger. And so what ultimately on a causal basis is responsible for major problems here in the U.S. equities market? Is it capital flows in China, which are significant, or is it basic debt levels here in the United States, which are way out of step and frankly represent something that it's a ubiquitous problem, not only here in the United States, but globally? Too much debt is the problem of our day.
Yes, but you know, we criticize China often for trying to manage the perception of the people. We've talked about this back in the days when Russia was a communist country and they managed the perception of the people. But obviously, the plunge protection team, the Federal Reserve, don't want us to believe that debt is the problem. And so the plunge protection team, Dave, on those huge crash days, they were right there to step in and save the market.
Yeah, the mantra is, you know, buy the dip. This is a great time. Look at the values. And all the pundits from your Wall Street firms lined up in support of this. You know, Morgan Stanley actually suggesting that, you know, it's only once in a blue moon, which is about a 50-year occurrence, once in 50 years occurrence, that all of their signals are pointing for this being a perfect time to buy. And it's fascinating that they're saying that, because you look at the amount of leverage that's in the system, you look at valuation metrics, which are anything but cheap. And you have to say, well, yeah, this really is a question of managing perceptions. The plunge protection team stepped in late on Monday, that's August the 24th, and buoyed the prices in the afternoon. And it was interesting, even overseas, watching that action, because every forced rally was fed with more selling. And so, you know, the lows in and around 1860, I think those moving forward need to be watched carefully. That represents sort of short-term support. And getting below those numbers becomes sort of a Katie bar the door moment. Getting below what were the lows of a nasty sell-off suggests that you have much more constructive interests that just want out because they believe that the big picture has changed, growth dynamics have changed, and it's time to get liquid and get to cash. Now, it's interesting, when we're looking at things, it's often from a valuation perspective, and things are overvalued. Luis Yamada is a name that may be familiar to some of our listeners. It's certainly a name that I've brought into the commentary on a number of occasions, because it was her compatriot Alan and Louise, who were the team at Smith Barney running a technical team that had been together for about five decades. Alan Shaw was his last name. And they did some of the best technical analysis in the business. And about the time central banks became the dominant theme in the marketplace, Smith Barney decided they didn't need technicians anymore because, quite frankly, you know, what's a pretty picture tell you when the driving force in the market is really just money printing? Louise has been on her own since then and runs a great service. Her conclusion is that after 4 months of the market failing to reach new highs, we are signaling a bear market in U.S. equities. And so, again, you roll the clock back 4 months ago, and this had nothing to do with China. Now we can talk about China being somehow causally connected. But the reality is, we've had a difficult time making new highs. We've been grinding it out here for 3 or 4 months here in the U.S., and we've talked about the fact that the Russell 2000, the S&P Mid-Cap 400, I mean, these are indexes that have already peaked. They peaked months ago. We began to see a major expansion in the spread, talking about the credit markets. High-yield bonds began to, again, reflect some concerns long before we had these sort of last 2 weeks in August, the catastrophic decline seen there.
Does it feel, though, Dave, that the weather's changed a little bit? And
absolutely.
What I mean by that is, you know, we have looked at this market and said every time there's bad news, it's being taken as good news, which usually is a sign of a bull market. It seems now that bad news is being looked at as bad news by the investors.
You're right. Bull market dynamics, good news is good news, bad news is good news. There's always a reason for the stock market to move higher. And something amongst investors has changed. Sentiment has turned from bullish to bearish. You can listen to CNBC and they're still waving the pom-poms. You can turn on Bloomberg and there's every reason to be in the market and buying. But I'm telling you, amongst investors, sentiment has already turned from bullish to bearish. And again, all year long, up until the last 2-3 weeks, bad news has been, in a very sick and twisted way, good news, because it meant that the Fed would postpone a rate increase and keep easy and cheap money flowing for longer. That was the logic. So good news, good was good, bad was better, if that makes sense. And that has shifted. Now bad news is in fact bad news. And so, you know, really what has changed, I think two things. Number one, I think central bank activism, and this is where China does feature prominently in the equation, central bank activism on the part of the People's Bank of China has been shown to be ineffective in stopping the decline in stock prices, both in the Shanghai and Shenzhen markets. And this is critical because the popular narrative amongst investors and investment professionals has been that central banks can do whatever it takes, whenever they want, to direct outcomes and determine results. And that narrative is falling to pieces.
Well, do you think possibly it's falling to pieces because a lot of the tools have already been used? I mean, look at our own central bank, Dave. They've already kept rates near zero through what was supposed to have been an expansion. Now, if we're going back into a bear market or a recession, what tools do they have left?
Right. So the second component of central bank activism being proven as ineffective is beginning to encroach on the minds of investors. I think the second issue is the honest appraisal, a growing recognition that rates are already at the zero bound. We're at 0%. That leaves the Fed with limited options. So if in fact emerging markets and Chinese market declines become contagious, then the Fed really doesn't have that many tools in the toolbox. QE is always an option. Quantitative easing is always an option. But as a policy tool, it to date has done very little to boost economic activity.
Right.
And I emphasize economic activity because it did have an effect in terms of asset price inflation. And it went a long way towards exaggerating the income and wealth gaps, which in and of themselves are becoming now very politically contentious. Ergo, if the Fed issues a new round of quantitative easing, it would have to be in the context where they had sufficient political cover. Does this make sense?
Well, what would that mean? I mean, thousands of points more off the stock market?
Yeah, I think they could step in closer to the 14,000 range on the Dow. So take another 2,000 points off of a recent low. And I think what you'll have is the general public moving from being critical of Fed interventionism, which they have become more and more so in recent months, to being Fed desperate and just basically saying, please stop the pain. Isn't there something that you can do? And on the basis of having political cover, I think you could have another round of QE. But having it done right now would suggest, I think, too much to the global community that we're in desperate straits. And they've got to be very, very careful that they don't send that message too soon.
Well, and we've talked about velocity of money being very, very low. And in the past, they've been able to issue QE in a low velocity environment. When people stop trusting the currency, the velocity can jump very quickly. Don't you think quantitative easing, playing with that again, even though we didn't really get much of an economic boost out of it last time, do you think that could actually turn into, down the road, a hyperinflationary scenario?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's the way that people are behaving. The more concerned they become, the more desperate they are to pull funds from everything. So it may be that the government's attempt at quantitative easing could exacerbate a deflationary trend, not an inflationary or hyperinflationary trend, as people decide to suck money out of the system. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but it's an interesting phenomenon. In this market sell-off, this is a very important dynamic to keep in mind because, again, sort of in that same issue of something amongst investors has changed, right? The normal asset allocation shift when people get concerned is from stocks, which are considered higher risk, to bonds, which are considered slightly lower risk. That's the consideration. It may not actually be the case, but that's the way people believe and often behave. In this most recent market sell-off, you had just as much money being pulled out altogether and money coming out of bond funds. And that's interesting because ordinarily the first shift when you're concerned is stocks to bonds, not stocks to cash. And so the allocation shift suggests that people think that there is something severely wrong, and this may not be just a 10% market correction. When people want out of the system, again, that's suggestive of a complete change amongst investors in the context of investor sentiment.
Well, let's go back to this bear market mentality then, okay? Because there have been sell signals that have been coming across. Like you said, this isn't a new phenomenon. In the last few months, we've had sell signals. But in these markets, what are the sell signals right now? I mean, if a person's listening and they have a fairly broad stock portfolio right now, what should they do?
Well, I mentioned on a technical basis, Luis Yamada would argue we've got long-term technical sell signals. Mm-hmm. I think this is consistent with what we've already seen. The price action of the S&P mid-caps, your Russell 2000s, which are your smaller companies. And we were talking about this 6 weeks ago, Kevin. I mean, as early as March and then again in June, you had signals of a market top in your smaller markets. It was the bellwethers, the S&P 500 and the Dow, which were sort of bucking the trend. And if you recall, 2011, 2012, 2013, we also saw a significant monthly sell signals. These are long-term sell signals, and they ended up being nullified by massive central bank intervention. Do you remember our conversation about the Economic Cycles Research Institute?
Right.
And their call for recession? In each of those years, 2011, 12, and 13, those were all supposed to be years where we headed into recession, looking at major business cycles, and then I think also coupling that with market dynamics.
And like you said, that was nullified by central bank intervention. I mean, we really should have gone into recessions at those times, but the central bank just printed more money.
And what that's created is an interesting dynamic in the minds of investors where, yep, things start to get bad, you get a little sell-off in the markets, and then you've got a big announcement. And the big announcement is what buoys the markets again to old highs and maybe takes it to new highs. So let's go back in time. 2011, you had the European crisis in full bloom. Draghi promised unlimited resources. Do you remember that?
No, I do.
And so here we are with the markets not doing well circa 2011 and his promise of the sun, moon, and stars in terms of European resources, an immense, it was an unlimited promise.
Right. We'll do whatever we need.
We'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Then in 2012, you've got Ben employed quantitative easing 3. That's 2012, buoys the markets as it's getting to a soft patch. And that was followed by Abenomics, which was launched that December.
Along came Japan.
And then not even a year into that, you've got the Bank of Japan's QQE scheme, which was introduced to underscore the commitment to market levitation. What was that? I think that's April 2013. So the signals are telling you something important, that the markets are, in a natural sense, the markets are exhausted. And the economies they represent need to and should correct, that you should see a natural ebb and flow in the marketplace, and it's not being allowed to occur.
Well, let me ask, though, you had talked about China's commitment to bring trillions in at some point into the market. I mean, is that going to be large enough to maybe save the rest of the world?
It remains to be seen. If the Chinese can introduce a big enough check and underwrite the next quasi-recovery and market rally. So it remains to be seen. I mean, now we're just talking about a question of trillions. A trillion here, a trillion there. Eventually, we're talking about real money, aren't we?
Right.
And so at some point, people realize that this is something of a perception game. A trillion here, a trillion there. Eventually, people realize that why didn't we try this 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago?
Well, maybe because it doesn't work.
And that's, I think, a harsh reality that runs contrary to the narrative of central planners, which is to say, of course we can control this. Of course we can make it happen. When the Chinese suggest, as they have here in the last 48 hours, Saturday, in fact, Saturday of this weekend, it's done. The downside is done. That is a massive commitment. On the scale of a Mario Draghi, we're going to do everything. Now, they're either going to do everything and anything that it takes to levitate equities in the Chinese market, or they've just put their reputation completely on the line. And they may, in fact, be utterly discredited from this point forward. The PBOC and the People's Communist Party in China may look very foolish in years to come because of that sort of strong prognostication. And they've got to deliver, well, they promised to already, $8 trillion in spending between now and 2020.
I think the troubling thing, though, Dave, is if it does not work, okay, then now we are in a bear market. interest rates are still at zero. This is a scary time.
Sure. And so you look at the last several years in retrospect, and you can see that a monetary baton was passed from one central bank to another, which has created sufficient liquidity to assuage any panic in the markets. This has been what has kept things stitched together for the last 5, 6, 7 years, is the monetary job, the heavy lifting, so to say, first with the Fed, then with the ECB, then with the Bank of Japan, now with the PBOC, the People's Bank of China. Is it going to be sufficient? Or at some point, do you have this sort of wake-up moment where people say, it's nothing more than a Ponzi scheme? I mean, it's, I guess, some form of financial success, but what is it based on exactly? If we're entering a bear market at this point, it's particularly troubling for two reasons. One, because, as you well know, rates are already at zero. And two, the Fed balance sheet is already at a lofty $4.5 trillion. And for those less familiar with U.S. financial history, this would be the first occasion where slipping into recession occurred with rates already at zero. This would be the first time. And again, you may ask that question again of how far you can stretch the imagination. How far will the American investor or our foreign creditors look at a $4.5 trillion balance sheet? Will they allow it to expand to 9 before they revolt, 12 before they revolt? How many trillions of dollars in debt, implicit leverage in the Fed's balance sheet, will be allowed before there is a currency and bond market revolt? I mean, the return of the bond market vigilante is something that it gets discounted today because it looks like the central banks of the world can do what they want and deliver on any promise they make. But at some point, there may be a return, and the bond market vigilante is essentially the market in total voting and driving rates through the moon.
Well, Dave, then I think somebody's going to have to inform Wall Street about the volatility. You know, we've looked at various investment outlooks. We've had clients send them to us, say, hey, what do you think about this? These guys are saying there's really not going to be much volatility and it's all growth from here. I think of Fisher's analysis.
Isn't that interesting? Beginning of the year, low volatility and growth ahead. And granted, they're a small player in the mix, but if you look at the estimates, say for the S&P 500, the most conservative estimate on Wall Street today is coming from Goldman Sachs, where we should finish the year with the S&P at around 2100. Slightly more aggressive would be Stifel Nicolaus, expecting to finish the year with the S&P around 2350. There's virtually universal agreement from, you know, in between that 2100 and 2350. You've got Bank of America at 2200, JP Morgan at 2250, and the consensus of probably a dozen other firms right in around 2300. In other words, the stock market's going to finish the year with a good 10-15% gain, and that's what you should expect for 2015.
Well, and that comes from an expectation. I mean, let's give them credit. That comes from an expectation of the central bank confidence game continuing. Over the last 3-4 years, it really has worked. Now, what if the confidence game is falling apart?
And I think this is why this piece on China is so significant, because at least in terms of their market intervention, they have not been as effective as the plunge protection team has here in the United States. They haven't worked out the machinery, what trades to put on and when, and how to execute them in a way that buoys the stock market when you need it to be buoyed. It's a good question. What if confidence in the money mandarins is now diminishing? Let me put this out here. Here's a bit of evidence for that very thing. You've got the usual defensive shift from stocks to bonds. And we talked about this a minute ago, but look at it as evidence that actually people don't have confidence in the system as a whole, supported by a central bank and monetary policies. You got the usual defensive shift from stocks to bonds. As stocks begin to sell off, people sell stocks and move into bonds. You get a boost in bond prices as demand increases.
And you said it's different this time.
It's not happening this time. Bonds and stocks have both been sold. And it's curious. It's worth reflecting on. If people want to eliminate all risk from the equation and bonds are not a sufficient safe haven, then sentiment is radically shifting, suggesting that this very well, maybe the big one. And what I mean by the big one, a major correction where people just basically say, I'm taking my marbles and going home. I don't want any diversified portfolio. I just want to be in cash. I just want out. Get me out. And those three words, I think, may be the most memorable words from 2015. Get me out.
Well, and it's not just the market that people are looking at. You know, we're coming into an election year. Politics is, I would have to think it's going to be affected by this day.
You know, I look at Trump, I look at Sanders, I sometimes scratch my head, I still have some hair, and it's not a flop over. If Trump and Sanders represent a growing dissatisfaction with the elites and the establishment types, the context may be ripe for a collapse in confidence. And think about this. There is long presumed in the currency and bond markets that the Fed and the central banks are all-powerful. Mm-hmm. And yet, if they're found to be feeble, you've got a context where people are basically disestablishment in their orientation. Again, because Sanders is, he's an outlier for the Democrats. The DNC has got to be very disturbed by the fact that he's getting as much traction as he is, because he just says what he wants to say, and he does what he wants to do, which, that's not how you play politics, okay? That's not how power operates in the two-party system we have today. And the RNC is equally concerned, because here's, again, sort of the outlier. Trump says what he wants to say. He's not getting consultation as he's writing his speeches. The RNC is on the outside looking in, and he's just saying it like it is. And again, I think that speaks to a general dissatisfaction with the elites and the establishment, which has been governing things for a long period of time. And again, I think that suggests that we could have a major turn of events relating to the currency market as well as the bond market, as we've held them up or had them held up by the Fed.
Well, and if the Federal Reserve and the central bankers are not able to keep this confidence game going, you know what it reminds me of, Dave? The Fed chairman. Just pretend for a second the Fed chairman is the captain in the movie Titanic. After the iceberg's been struck, do you remember he could not believe that it actually happened? He was still using an old model. This ship can't sink. This ship can't sink. I think about the Federal Reserve here recently talking about the Phillips curve and how they're still following old models.
This is exactly the point, where if the general public understood how old school the Fed was, not actually operating with cutting edge technologies and ideas, but very old school in their thinking, I think they would be disturbed. And again, I think this is a part of what makes for the undoing of the Fed in the years to come. Wall Street Journal ran an article recently titled, "The Fed Has a Theory." And I forget what the subtitle was. But in this Wall Street Journal article, it explains that one of the assumed and operating theories at the Fed is the Phillips curve. And the Phillips curve links employment with inflation. And the problem is that that theory was discredited in the 70s, and it was discredited again in the 80s,
yeah.
And it was discredited again in the 90s. And this is the trouble with academics. There is a lot of vested interest in the theories they learned in school and integrated into their PhD theses. I did, that was with a TH, although it might smell. I think this is the difference between a market practitioner and an academic. Market practitioners know that the Phillips curve is now sort of a false idea. But academics, they have yet to acknowledge this. And in the process of sort of delegating responsibility, we've given them the keys to the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And I think the Journal article is very important. The Wall Street Journal article is important because thematically, it complements this idea of confidence being lost, perhaps sooner than later. Think about it. When the general public says to themselves, wait a minute, you knew this? You knew that this didn't work? And yet you were still operating with it as a part of your modeling?
You knew the ship was going to sink and you didn't tell me?
And again, just imagine the look of consternation and disbelief. I thought you knew better.
Right.
The general public appraising the confidence game that the Fed has held in place since the panic days of 2008 and 2009, and they're still holding on to something as foolhardy as the Phillips curve?
You know, Dave, central banks around the world, though, have just basically thrown the towel in and said, you know what, we're going to buy stocks. We're just going to go ahead and buy into any market or sell into any market. Ours has been doing it secretly as well.
Well, I mean, we know the plunge protection team.
Okay.
We know that what they do, how they do it. We also know that they can call upon Wall Street firms to buy equity index futures to influence the trends in the marketplace. We're well aware of the monetization schemes that, you know, the Fed has employed, that other central banks have used to buy mortgages and government paper with freshly printed credits. So these are behaviors that amongst central bankers are now considered normal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, think of that.
It was shocking at one point. Now it's normal.
Now it's normal. So the guys that are on the outside of normal would be like the Bank of Japan buying up shares of companies, directly investing in the Japanese stock market. Now, of course, the Fed's been prohibited from that kind of behavior by their own rules of the road, so to say. But this was interesting. As our friend Bill King has brought to our attention, there's an amendment to the Federal Reserve Act, which was put in place in 2010. Section 13.3 allows for a loophole, which is lending money to other entities so they can purchase shares. Mm. So the Fed can say with a straight face, we don't own Pfizer, Coca-Cola, Disney, or IBM.
But here's a little free money so that you can.
So that you can buy it for us. And these are the ones that we want you to buy. And so, I mean, it's interesting. There is this possibility that we see in the next 6 months the Swiss National Bank and their balance sheet fully brought into the spotlight. By the way, all of this would be very clear if we did an audit of the Fed. Mm. We'd see the capital flows and we'd see in what ways are they gaming the system. And I think the general public should know that, but I doubt it's ever going to happen. If we did an audit of the Fed, I think you would see the money trail from the Fed to the Swiss National Bank, which would help us understand why the Swiss National Bank is sitting on such a large portfolio of shares in ExxonMobil, Microsoft, Google, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, General Electric, Verizon, Pfizer, Coca-Cola, Disney, IBM, Gilead, Amazon, Facebook, Merck. I mean, there is a huge equity portfolio sitting at the Swiss National Bank. And I think if push came to shove, the Swiss National Bank, in answer to the Swiss people, would say, well, actually, you know, you scratch our backs, we scratch yours. It's an arrangement that we have with the Fed. I think that they would say, actually, it's not our money. It's borrowed, and the purchases were made on behalf of the Fed. We're not there yet, but we ask whether or not the behavior of the Fed isn't unlike that of other central banks, sometimes operating in the light of day, sometimes operating in the shadows. And yes, the Chinese have been manipulating prices higher. They've earmarked hundreds of billions of dollars to step in and buy shares in the stock market. As you mentioned earlier, perhaps they're going to put an end to the decline in the stock market. Well, the best way to end the decline in the stock market is to quit let it trading.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It will never go down. It might not ever go up again. But at a minimum, we see the Fed and other central banks included continuing to attempt keeping equity prices from falling below critical levels.
Well, and it's not just equity prices that people watch. You know, it's amazing to me when you see the amount of government spending increase that is coming in here, how they were able to apply that to an increase in the GDP. Management of perception. I mean, GDP just jumped.
I want to go back to a conversation that I had with a wealth management client of ours at the end of June, maybe it was the first week of July, and it was a frustrated conversation. The question on the table was, if the Fed has manipulated prices of the Dow to 18,000, why can't they continue to manipulate prices indefinitely? And if that's the case, why wouldn't we go long the Dow and own it exclusively? We know that it's a targeted index. We know that between that and the S&P 500, these are bellwethers that signal and advertise well from a PR standpoint. They advertise well the direction of the economy and hopefully will someday also influence retail behavior, consumer behavior. So if we know that there's vested interest in getting these prices higher, why don't we throw our lot in with
right.
the Fed?
If you can't beat them, join them.
If you can't beat them, yeah. join them was the gist of the conversation. And I think it's worth right here and right now, looking at what has been and can be a pretty catastrophic decline. In the case of the Chinese, it's 40% off of the peak number. And I don't think the Chinese government wanted as much as 1% or 2% off of those peak numbers. They liked continual progress forward, not 1, 2, or 3 steps back. In the U.S. market, you see the same thing. Some of your financial firms off of recent peaks have, in the context of 30 days, declined by 20%. And so again, this notion of the Fed can keep things going indefinitely, Kevin, it's unmitigated balderdash. You can manipulate markets in the short run, but ultimately the market vote prevails.
So if you can't beat them, desert them. In other words, don't join them because you'll go down with them, but you can desert them. You talked about being in cash and gold over and over and over. If you were in cash and gold through the last few weeks, you wouldn't have been hurt.
Well, right. So back to this issue of other numbers that are contorted and twisted. We have the second quarter GDP, which here in the last 10 days was revised up to 3.7% from 2.3%. And lo and behold, as you dig into the details, we had the largest increase in government spending in 5 years, which was the biggest input, if you will, towards improving that number. And very curiously, if you're looking at gross domestic income, which generally tracks GDP on a very consistent basis, you had very little improvement. So for anyone paying attention here, this is very critical. GDP and GDI usually run in a parallel track. GDP is moving up. GDI is not. Something smells. This is one of those Denmark moments. Something's right. Fishy in Denmark.
It's another perception.
Yeah. So it is. It's a perception issue. And you have at the same time the Atlanta Fed, you know, they have their GDP Now computer model of what current GDP is doing. It just took another lower drop from 1.4 to 1.2%. The official number is saying, yes, we have improvement. While the Fed's own internal model says it's in decline. Sorry. Do you see what's going on here?
We know we're being managed. And actually, this wealth management client was right. You know, if they're going to be able to manage it for forever, if they would be able to manage it forever, why wouldn't you play the game? We're starting to see that they can't manage it. We're starting to see conflicting numbers. China, however, keeps coming back up in my mind because you were there, like you said, when this was happening. And China seems to be the pivot point at this point. If China succeeds, we may have more growth. If China fails, then there's no one to catch us.
No, I want to just a brief discussion on China. It is unfair to lay full blame for the recent market volatility on China. That's what some pundits have attempted to do. We here in the West have a lot of leverage in the system. China represents a trigger. They represent a pressure point for the much greater issues, which are both here and abroad. That is too much debt. The global economy is supporting way too much debt. When I was in China and Singapore, I spent many hours visiting with a top economics professor from Beijing. And in a nutshell, he views the current Chinese unwind as far more significant to the global markets than the subprime lending crisis was in 2008 and 2009.
So he sees more impact to what's happening right now in China than the subprime impact in 8.
And a part of that is because it's triggering an unwind of a vast carry trade, which has allowed for trillions of dollars, not only in corporate, but speculative investor money as well, to be borrowed in three different currencies, euro, yen, and dollars, and invested in what was considered to be a better bet. So what we're seeing now is 3 to 5% currency swings in a day, whether we're talking about Australia, New Zealand, Russia, Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Chile, Turkey. These are disturbing signs of money quickly leaving markets. That is an unwind to a carry trade. And a part of this is being predicated on things that were assumed to be the case, which are proving not to be the case. It has been assumed that China would continue to be a growth engine. Last year, Kevin, China contributed better than a third of all global growth. Looking at GDP growth, over a third of it came from China. Half of the world's manufacturing last year came from China. And this is with them slowing down in their manufacturing and export industries and shifting towards a more service-based economy. This is causing major, major issues for the Chinese, watching concern, watching money exit the system. Watching capital flight out of all emerging markets is making it much harder for China in real time to effect this change towards a service-oriented economy. And it's causing them to rely even more heavily on this infrastructure project that I mentioned earlier. Opening up the old Silk Road and allowing for energy and trade to flow directly to Europe, reducing the time frame involved. Currently, shipping times can be 1 to 3 months, depending on the destination from China, if they're taking the quote-unquote slow boat. But by putting things on a fast train through 26 countries, you've got the ability to deliver goods within days. And this is their goal. Their goal is to reglobalize and be at the center of that reglobalization theme, cutting the rest of the world out. And, you know, if they're wrong, China will have lost 40 years worth of accumulated wealth. And that's what is at stake. Scholars are now squaring off against each other on what the issues are and what the issues will be.
Is it any wonder that people are wondering what in the world happens to the dollar during a period of time like this? Because obviously China has shown, even on billboards throughout China, that they're interested in having their own currency as a reserve currency or as a world acceptable trade currency.
Yep. The biggest issue underscoring the Chinese markets and ours is the destabilizing dynamics relating to debt. If you're over encumbered, that equals underperformance with the possibility of failure always present. We're going to come back to that in future weeks to not only look at some of the Chinese dynamics, this large infrastructure project that is being proposed, but also this idea of being over encumbered initially equaling underperformance and ultimately opening up the possibility of failure.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.